Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
This is Father Frank Lane, and we're continuing our program, Foundations in Faith. We're following the Gospel of St. Matthew, and today we come to Matthew chapter 22, 15 to 21. It's a fascinating gospel, and it leaves us, of course, with many, many questions. And so it's good for us to reflect upon it, to pray over it, and to find within it those things which are relative to our own age, our own time, our own place. Still in this Matthew's part of the gospel, Jesus is interacting with the leaders of the Jewish community. This time, what it did was they're talking about the relationship between Palestine and the Roman Empire. And so it begins. The Pharisees went away to work out between them how to trap Jesus in what he said. So obviously they're going to be disingenuous in their question, and they're going to try and put him in an impossible situation. They do that often, and why they persist is kind of puzzling, because they always kind of get euchred in their little plans, and it happens again this time as well. And so they sent their disciples to him together with the Herodians. It was at this time, of course, that Herod Antipas was in Jerusalem. So while it's the Pharisees and the Herodians are an odd kind of gathering, it isn't altogether impossible that they had gotten together to go after Jesus. And so they say, "Master, we know that you are an honest man, and you teach the way of God in an honest way, and that you are not afraid of anyone, because a man's rank means nothing to you." And so they began then, of course, approaching him as kind of a great moral teacher, flattering him and saying, "You know, we know that you have demonstrated that you're not particularly concerned about people's class, whether it be high or low, and therefore you kind of have an influence with all classes, all ranks of people." So they're saying, "You know, you're a very influential person in our midst, and so that's why we're coming to you." Matthew already, however, informs us that they have something very, very different in mind. And so then they say to him, "Tell us your opinion then. Is it permissible to pay taxes to Caesar?" Now, why is this a trick question? Well, it's a trick question for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is that before the coming of the Roman Empire, Palestine was in the midst of bloody anarchy, and that there was no order, and that there was constant fighting and constant clannish wars and all of those kinds of things. There was no settledness, there was no stability whatsoever to the society, and it was wrapped in violence. And wrapped in violence because it was following the ancient understanding of justice, which was an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And so basically justice was based on the concept of revenge and not on the concept of law. The result was that the Jewish leaders are the ones who invited the Roman Empire in. One thinks, actually, historically, it's kind of interesting, because the same situation was in Ireland before the 11th century. And eventually King Dermot McMurrogh of Leinster was the one who invited the English to come in and bring order into the Irish countryside. And that's when they landed at Waterford and came up and stayed actually an occupying force in Ireland until after the First World War, and a forceful and dominant force up to the declaration of the Free State in 1949. So we're talking about close to 1,000-year domination. But the same situation, however, it was a king of Leinster who invited the English into Ireland, and it is the Jewish leadership who invites the Roman Empire into Palestine. So then the question becomes, however, that is it legal to pay taxes to Caesar? This was a legitimate moral question for them. Because we know certainly from the Old Testament, we know certainly from the book of Judges and so forth, and the book of Kings, that there is only one Lord of Israel, and that is the Lord God, the Most High God. And that in order to acknowledge sovereignty over them by anybody but God was, in fact, a tremendously deep and complex moral issue. Many people were deeply and honestly troubled by this. What is it that we are supposed to be doing? And we know that our own people have invited the Romans in. We know that we dislike their occupation. We know that we refuse to acknowledge Caesar as a god, which has become terribly problematic later on when Caesar begins to himself think he's a god. So what should they be doing? Knowing that if Jesus says to them, no, you shouldn't pay taxes to Caesar, then he's guilty of sedition, and they can definitely turn him over to the Roman authorities for execution. If he says, oh, yeah, it's all right to pay taxes to Caesar, then he's betraying the conscience of an awful lot of his the Hebrew people, who by saying, yeah, it's all right to acknowledge a foreign sovereignty over you, one besides that of the living God. And so this is the position they think cleverly that they have put Jesus into. But Jesus, of course, is more clever than they always and smarter than they always. And Matthew assures us that Jesus was aware of their malice. And so he replied, you hypocrites, why do you set this trap for me? Let me see the money you pay taxes with. And they handed him a denarius. And he said, whose head is this? Whose image is this? Whose name? Caesar's, they replied. And he said to them, very well, give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, and to God what belongs to God. So he has once again tricked them and once again avoided the snare, the trap. But it's a serious answer. It's not just a clever way to diffuse the conversation. It's a very serious, very serious issue. And what he is basically saying is that don't give your hearts and your minds to the Roman Empire, to Caesar. But you're paying them to protect you. You're paying them. Pay them their just wage for responding to the invitation of Palestine, keeping order in Palestine, supplying whatever they supply as far as public works or protection and so forth goes. But the sovereignty that you acknowledge over you has to be God. It is a perfect response to that. Many people say, well, this is the original statement of the separation of church and state. Well, it is not. It is simply the acknowledgement of an existential situation, a practical situation in first century Palestine. And it is structured around the particular structure of that, where a foreign occupation force, which has invited in, provides order and protection in exchange for taxes, while not claiming at all the sovereignty over the human heart, over the human person. They still must obey the law. They still must obey the Torah. They still must live according to the law of Moses. They still must live in accordance with the dictates and the spirit of the covenant. They are not ceding that to the state at all. And so it's a practical solution to a practical problem. And it does not in any way establish for us an ongoing theology of the relationship between church and state. As a matter of fact, this is reiterated. Jesus' answer is reiterated. We know, for instance, in the letter of Peter, and also Paul himself in Romans 13 reminds us of our obligations to the civil authorities. But this becomes very different in the years just following Jesus' death when, for instance, the emperor begins to declare himself a god and demands what we would call veneration or worship. And this, is, of course, lies at the root of the Christian problem. If Jesus had established a forever idea of the relationship between church and state, then the whole idea of the persecutions of the Christians would not have taken place. But the ones who changed the rules of what Jesus said were the Roman emperors themselves. No longer were they simply political leaders over Israel. Now they were proclaiming themselves to be the God of Israel. And they were usurping that which belonged only to Yahweh. The Christians, therefore, must resist that. And the Jews are given an exemption from that because of the nature of the unsettledness of their state. And in order to preserve a peace, they are given kind of an exemption. They're identified as an isopolitia, an isolated polity within the Roman Empire that is exempt from emperor worship. But when the Christians began to be expelled from the synagogue, they no longer can call themselves Jews. They no longer also then experience the exemption that the Roman Empire has given them. The result of that is that they are now exposed to the full force of Roman law. And you cannot take this, render to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's, because there is no longer a clear distinction within the Roman Empire of the difference between God and Caesar. And so in resisting, therefore, to violate their obligation to bow to the sovereignty of the Creator God and the Lord Jesus Christ, they must refuse to worship the emperor as a divinity. That results in the persecutions, the early Roman persecutions. Now, there's some revisionist history that is saying, oh, well, that never took place. Well, I don't know if Candida Moss writes that. I don't know if she says it never took place, but she says it was never on a very large scale. However, personal testimonies from the age, primary sources, would tend to dispute with her. They might say the numbers were not as great, maybe, as were told in the stories, but the fact that there was a general persecution of Christians is something that there's just too much historical fact for it to say, oh, well, that's all up in the air. That's not really for sure. We don't really know that is true. Well, we do know it is true, and we know it is true from the primary source material of the age. And we know that this went up all the way through the reign of Diocletian and Decius, all the way up to the Edict of Toleration, the Edict of Milan issued by the Emperor Licinius in the year 313 AD. So this particular response to the Pharisees and the Herodians was not a response that remained unchanged for all ages, because the circumstances changed. When the Roman Empire changes from a political entity to a religion, then that creates a whole different, then you cannot render to Caesar that which is Caesar's, because Caesar is claiming that which does not belong to him, which belongs only to the living God. So then as we move forward then with this question, if this is not the final definition of separation of church and state, which is a very modern phenomenon, and one of the pioneers in that, of course, is the American Constitution and the American Revolution, in which the reason for the separation of church and state in the American Constitution is because they came out of England that had an established church, and they did not want the established church of England to be the established church of the United States as well. They had too many dissenting groups. They had certainly the Quakers in Pennsylvania, and they had the Baptists in Rhode Island and Connecticut. They had the Puritans in Massachusetts. And so there was now already pre-existent within the United States when the Constitution was written a radical diversification of religious manifestations and religious experiences. They did not want to squash those by imposing the Church of England upon the 13 colonies or the newly formed nation of the United States. That's the whole intention of the amendment about the non-establishment clause. Certainly, It has, like the emperor and Palestine in the first century, it certainly has gone through profound changes through subsequent interpretations of the article, and has come down to something that basically would be fairly surprising, actually, to the founders of the new republic in North America. The idea that religion and politics can have nothing to do with each other in the public square, which is where we've kind of come to with the non-establishment clause, is something that is unique in history, and we're finding out it's very destructive in history as well. And it's interesting to note, for instance, there's a fine book by a man named Stephen Carter published a while ago and called The Culture of Disbelief, in which he shows the power that religion exercised on the moderation of the extremes of the Constitution throughout the 19th century, and especially in relationship to the whole question of slavery. For it was primarily the Methodists who were the abolitionists, and they were the ones who held the feet of the Constitution, and its prejudice toward the right of private property held its feet to the fire. And over the whole question of slavery, we know that constitutionally, it seems you could just have justified it, that the Roger Taney and the Dred Scott decision, essentially a states' rights decision, but one that had profound implications also for the institution of slavery in the United States. So Carter shows the damage that can be done when the moral persuasion of Christianity is removed as an element of constitutional interpretation. It allows radical constitutional, materialistic constitutional interpretation, which we have experienced certainly in the Roe v. Wade decision, which is legally and historically founded on the same principles that slavery was founded on. You'll find the pro-abortion people crying foul when someone says that, but they're certainly, once again, it's a question of that's historically correct. The whole process of the law is exactly the same process. It simply has another object to it. So then it comes to our own particular question. If that's true, if in fact the United States government supports slavery, as it did in the Dred Scott decision, and says that another person is able to be owned by someone else because of their status, social status of dependency, then what happens when we move into Roe v. Wade is the same principle, except it's no longer a social status of dependency, now it's biological dependency. And so it's only logical that it moves this same kind of mentality, moves from abortion to euthanasia and so forth. Whenever a person is not able to stand on their own, then their whole basic fundamental civil right to life is in question. When that happens, what is the Christian's responsibility to the state? Certainly, this is extremely complex. And it certainly comes to the fore in the modern American political scene. And without getting deep into that and getting into all sorts of problems and trouble with that, let us just say this, that we have a primary obligation to God. We have the primary obligation to be faithful to God. We do not have an obligation to compromise between objective reality and subjective interpretation. This becomes, in some way, shape, or form, kind of the modern mantra of the moderate. And it's very difficult to sustain that theologically. You can do all sorts of mental gymnastics with it. But the fact of the matter is the objective reality that has been the wound in the heart of the American Republic from the very beginning has been the horror of slavery. And that same legal mentality has moved itself into now the horror of taking the life of innocent children simply because they are biologically dependent on another human being. Just as the slave was socially and materially and economically dependent on the slave owner. The argument is the same. It comes from common law. It comes from all the way back. And as a matter of fact, that it is even, we see it in the whole evolution and the whole development of the whole law of trying to figure out in English common law, which morphed into American constitutional law, what are the rights of every individual? What are they? And how do they apply to that, to the societal construction, to the construction of a human political society? We have seen, for instance, over and over, that it's social dependency, economic dependency, children, women, servants, so forth, were not entitled to civil rights because they were not free, independent persons. And even in the Articles of Confederation in the American Constitution, 1787, I believe, there is a necessity for anyone who is enfranchised, anyone with the right to vote, had to own at least a 200 shilling freehold. In other words, they had to have a dog in the fight. And that was the mentality, that civil rights, voting rights, depended upon independence and the independence of the self, which was the value that we got from the English Enlightenment. The result of it was, of course, it led to all sorts of unfortunate things. We know the story of the indentured servants. We know the whole business of the slave trade, which began back in the 17th century. And now we know the denial of fundamental basic civil rights to biologically dependent persons. What obligation do we owe the state as believing Christians? When the state changes in a way, in the 1860s, it was concluded that in the South, that they did not own allegiance to the state because the state refused to recognize their sovereignty to own other human beings. In the North, once again, the abolitionist movement was very powerful. And it came from Christianity, primarily from Methodism, and it became kind of the moral foundation of the Civil War. The economics foundation of the Civil War was tariffs and manufacturing and so forth. But the moral component that surfaced and that inflamed people's imagination, inflamed their zeal, their righteousness, and so forth, was the abolition movement, the abolition of slavery. So in the modern age, what is it that we owe the modern state? We cannot go back to render to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's, because once, in fact, you cross that line, which we have crossed from the beginning, to claim sovereignty over God's creation, sovereignty over human life, and not acknowledge, therefore, that all human life belongs to God and comes from God. Once the state, and this has been a constant problem within the United States from the 18th century on, and in the colonies far 100 years before that at least. What is the obligation of the Christian? In the abolitionist movement, the obligation of the Christian seems to be to have driven the state to a radical stance on human rights and to work then through the unfortunate mechanisms of war to end that kind of illegitimate understanding of civil law. Today, we face certainly in our whole pro-life movement, the whole pro-life issue, very, very clear. You know, there's a difference between the objectivity of, take the Civil War. There is the objectivity of the ownership of slaves. It's either right or it's wrong. There is subjective judgment on the virtue of tariffs. and of manufacturing policy. And while they may have moral consequences and moral components, they do not take the same place within the moral discussion as did the abolition of slavery. And I think that we're faced with that today as well. It's not possible for us to say we owe unfettered loyalty to the state, even when the state is, like the Roman Empire, claiming the right that belongs to God as their own right, the right over the life and death of a human being. And I think that all of the other social issues are a matter of judgment and prudence, open to compromise, open to discussion, open to political maneuvering back and forth. But the idea of a human life, that's not a subjective judgment. That's an objective reality. A person is either alive or they are dead. And so by presuming to pass Roe v. Wade, to enforce Roe v. Wade, is crossing the same line that was crossed in Scripture when Jesus, first of all, allowed for secular authority to rule over Israel, but did never allow for the secular authority to claim the divine right of being God himself. In the Roe v. Wade, the same transition seems to have been made, where we move from the secular state ensuring the order and the good functioning and the peacefulness of within a human society and functioning as a secular government to which we certainly can give our acknowledgement and pay our taxes and so forth, to now claiming a right that belongs to God alone. And so the same confusion that entered into Israel after the statement by Jesus enters now into the American scene, into the American political life. Israel never did figure out how to deal with it really well. And we are having a hard time trying to figure out how to deal with it pretty well. But the one thing that we must remember is there is a difference between objective reality and subjective judgment. That life and death are not subjective judgments. They are those realities of human life which belong to God and to God alone. What the state does, we can get involved in, and we can negotiate, and we can argue, and we can have all sorts of subjective solutions to problems. They are not the same thing. They're apples and oranges. And let us then, as we turn to the Lord on this most complex of situations, ask him to guide us and to direct us in the depths of our own hearts to kind of experience what the early Christians experienced in some way in their conflict and their difficulty and the extreme complexity of their relationship with the Roman Empire, which had now claimed divine authority.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com.